Welcome to The Mortgage Life, a space for down-to-earth conversations about how mortgages contribute to your life.
Well, that sounds canned and maybe a little boring.
What? There are so many parts to the mortgage industry and real estate finance we can explore and share with our listeners.
Okay, you're right. You're right, Mindy. Our goal is to help secure our clients' financial future.
I'm Pete Solomosi.
I'm Mindy Bodwin.
And I'm Sue Solomosi. We're your hosts. Welcome to The Mortgage Life. Today we have with us Christina Vinters. Thank you so much for joining us. Christina comes to us from Modern Separation. So you can take a second and maybe give us a little introduction of yourself, and then we'll dive into some questions.
Oh, sure. So I'm a family lawyer, and I practice primarily online family mediation. Basically, I help couples across BC peacefully resolve the details of their separation. In terms of my background, I came to that work from having practiced in the traditional adversarial legal system and basically became disillusioned with how stressful, slow, and expensive it was for my clients, even in relatively amicable situations. So back in 2016, I essentially designed a new process that actually took into account client preferences with things like flat fees and service availability in daytime and evening. But primarily the biggest difference is that I work together with couples as a neutral facilitator, which avoids that back and forth. So essentially I focus on efficiency so that people can move on with their lives.
One word we appreciate the most is efficiency in the mortgage space.
And I could imagine going through that end of relationship phase, how much efficiency matters. I find with my clients, I've had a lot of separation files this past year, and they always wonder, you know, what does the process look like? What is the timeline? It seems scary and intimidating. It's not something that most people go through multiple times. So I could imagine how valuable an efficient process would be.
Yeah, and unfortunately, a lot of people have heard the horror stories from their friends about the divorces that did actually take years. So it's nice for people to know that there is an option when they're willing to work together.
So it's a really interesting topic and a really important one. I've been a mortgage broker for, I suppose, nearly 16 years. And it's one piece that really surprised me. I wasn't expecting to see as many separations come through our door as we do. People looking for help with their mortgage when they're going through a separation. Purpose of this episode is really to try to help destigmatize it, help people pick up the phone when they do need help. It happens, you know, more often than you think. And that's what we're here for, is to help advise on the financial side. But we thought we'd bring you on, Christina, to talk about the lawyer side of it, the process leading into needing help from a mortgage broker. So let's start with the reason why we need a separation agreement.
Oh, sure. So there's a couple of reasons. In terms of practical reasons, a lot of lenders will not even approve financing without having an agreement in place. So that is just a practical logistical barrier that a lot of people face. But of course, the underlying reason for that is the legal protection that an agreement gives people. So in family law, it's a little bit different than other areas of law in that, generally speaking, a verbal agreement is not considered legally binding. And that's because of all the nuances involved in families that we don't want, you know, for example, coercion being an element of an agreement, that sort of thing. Or for example, one person is hoping to reconcile, so maybe they verbally agree to some terms that are not really in their favor. So the fact that a verbal agreement is not binding is, of course, problematic, because the purpose of an agreement in the context of a separation, one of the purposes is to understand your specific financial rights and obligations. And then based on those details, you can move forward to make new financial decisions about your life. If you actually can't rely on those details and that they can be subject to change, that can cause all kinds of problems for people down the road. And so that's really the primary basis for having an agreement properly documented in writing, is that it can actually be relied on going forward.
that's one of the main questions that I get with a spousal buyout or a separation file. Why do I need a separation agreement? That's going to cost me money. It's just every time, you know, and every time we have to, you know, help them understand this is a required document.
Yeah. So a proper separation agreement to be considered comprehensive is going to entail a full overview of all of the assets, debts, and incomes that each person in the couple has. And then that's basically considered the factual foundation of the agreement. So that full disclosure piece is the first step. And the next step is, what are they actually agreeing to do with all of that? Who's keeping which assets? How are things being divided? Who is responsible for which debts? And then of course, there's the support piece, child support, potentially spousal support, depending on the situation. And so the agreement sets out all of the information of basically what exists for this particular family and then what they're agreeing to do with all of that. And then the lenders, of course, use that information to decide whether or not they feel lending in this case is going to be a reasonable risk for them.
Can you comment on ownership rights as well? Because I know if there's not a legal separation agreement, you know, it's not just a handshake between two parties, is that, could there be an assumed existing ownership if through a spousal separation, if that isn't legally dealt with?
Yeah, absolutely. So if the couple has not dealt with their separation in writing, then those are just open legal issues that if one of them decides to make an issue out of it in the future, could cause some serious legal and financial problems.
I was going to say, that's, like you said, a lot of lenders, a majority of our lenders, won't lend money unless there's actually that separation agreement in place. I have seen it happen where there's like a signed agreement with the lawyer's office that this is going to take place in the future.
Like a statutory declaration, yeah. Something like that.
I've had it where somebody's been divorced for 20, 30 years and the lender still requires to see the legal separation agreement. I know in one case that agreement just didn't exist. And in that case, we were able to get a statutory declaration because it had been 30 years.
That brings us to the timeline question. Probably doesn't take 30 years to put a separation agreement in place.
Maybe if they can't agree.
Maybe.
Close too. It depends. So in the traditional adversarial process, unfortunately, it is quite a time-consuming process. It's not uncommon for it to take 6 months or more. A year to 2 years can happen if it's acrimonious. What I recommend for people and what I do is to work, although I am a family lawyer, the way that I run my practice is I work with both people together as a neutral mediator. And so that avoids the back and forth between lawyers, which is what tends to ramp up the costs and just really slow down the process. So if it's a relatively amicable process and they're going through that traditional system of lawyer, you know, one lawyer on each side, they can expect many months for that to work through towards resolution. Me personally, the way that I work is I've designed my system to be really focused on efficiency so that for the many people out there who are very reasonable and just need help getting their paperwork done, we've got a streamlined process to get all of that proper financial disclosure that I mentioned at the beginning done properly and documented. And so with us, most of our clients are finished within the month that they get started.
Wow, that's incredible.
I have a question that relates to what we talked about, and I don't think it was covered. When someone is going through a separation, we know that typically this happens when people are married, but how does it relate to others, like, for instance, that are common law?
Okay, so the colloquial term common law, what that refers to, legally, it's defined as having lived with another person in a marriage-like relationship for at least 2 years. That's the definition in British Columbia. And in most cases, that does mean physically living with another person for 2 years. There have been some sort of outlier cases where people have maintained two homes, but they've gone back and forth between them. Generally speaking, in most cases, though, people can consider themselves common law when they've been in the same home for 2 years. And it's after that 2 year mark that the ownership rights kick in BC.
And so would those ownership rights be the same as if they were married?
They are the same as if they were married. In a nutshell, basically what they're entitled to is half of any increase in value of assets over the course of the relationship. Notionally, and I can't give legal advice, it might vary, you know, depending on the particular situation. But in general, if somebody had assets at the beginning of the relationship, that value can potentially be protected for them later on if they separate. That's going to depend on a number of different factors, which I won't get into, but increases in value over those properties and also any new assets that have been accumulated in terms of savings or vehicles or properties, those would all be considered family property that could be divisible at the end of the relationship.
You used a word earlier that I had to look up. So I'm just going to define it. You used the word acrimonious, and I was like, that is a really nice word. What does it mean? So if anybody's wondering what acrimonious means, it means angry and bitter. That's what I found.
So that would be a not happy amicable. The opposite of amicable. One of the pieces that I'm sort of putting together here as I'm listening is you can have this kind of long drawn out process, or you can have a sort of more simplified, efficient process. And it sounds like at the end of the day, this separation agreement that is being created, a lot of it comes down to numbers, values of assets, spousal payment amounts, child support amounts. So where do those numbers come from?
Where do the numbers for things like the child support amounts come from?
Yeah, for any of those sort of pieces, because I know from our perspective, we're looking at the asset base or the value of the house, you know, that sort of forms the asset base. And then you have, like, how would a spousal payment be calculated? Is there a formula, or is it just individually determined?
There's two types of support. There's child support and spousal support. And we have federal guidelines that apply across Canada. They're the federal child support guidelines and the spousal support advisory guidelines. Along with those, there are standard formulas and software programs that we use to determine the amount payable, which is going to vary depending on the income of each party, the number of children, if there are any children, what the parenting arrangement is, if it's a shared parenting arrangement, or if the kids are primarily with one parent. And so there's quite a bit of information, some of which is just factual, objective information, other information which is a little bit more subjective and to be negotiated. But then once those are agreed on and plugged into the software, then that creates the calculations for us, where for child support, we get a specific number, and for spousal support, we get a range, which is essentially the ballpark within which people should be negotiating.
Okay, that's helpful. And for me to hear, I just, as a broker, again, you know, receiving these calls, sometimes we'll get a call early on in the process where a client is just kind of originating this separation, and they'll reach out and say, if this were to happen, you know, how much could I afford to buy? And we kind of have to work backwards with the type of house that they want to own, or even if they're going to buy out the existing matrimonial home, to see, you know, in the case if they were the higher income earning spouse, what spousal support payments would work for them, or vice versa, versus going through the whole legal process, developing the spousal, or the separation agreement, and then coming to look to see if you qualify for the mortgage, and you don't, right? So that's that part where it looks like there's a bit of a range in the spousal support.
Yes. And so for that reason, what I usually recommend is that when I meet with clients, we do some preliminary calculations to look at, based on their situation, what the support scenario might look like. And then if they are interested in a property transaction, then I send them off to mortgage brokers to look at what it is that they each need in order to be able to accomplish their goals. And I know that's also only preliminary on the mortgage end, because the lender can't approve without the signed separation agreements. It's a little bit frustrating for people that it's a bit circular. But once they've gotten that information, then they can come back to me and we can try to fine tune the details that is going to make the whole picture work for both of them.
It's a piece of understanding that financial picture and making sure that everybody that's working with you also understands the financial picture. There was something I was going to say and it was going to sound really smart. Oh yes, I remember. There's also another interesting little piece, and it's a very quirky tidbit on the mortgage side. But when we're looking at types of income other than employment income, such as child support, spousal support, child tax benefit from the government, some lenders will only allow us to use up to a certain ratio of that income towards the qualification. So like maximum 30% of the overall income can come from other sources other than employment. Not all lenders do that, but it's just a quirky little tidbit that sometimes we come up against where, you know, if somebody's got $10,000 in spousal support payments and that becomes the basis of their entire income, we may have a little bit more of a challenge finding lending.
And I think that comes back to the idea that you talked about, Christina, that this is a very collaborative process. So as a person is going through a separation, having that team around you, including your lawyer and your broker, having those people all working together, it really helps to get, hopefully, to a good conclusion.
And we can look at creative scenarios too. For example, if there is enough money available that perhaps a lump sum spousal support payment can be made rather than the monthly payments, that might allow the recipient spouse to put down a larger down payment, which will then facilitate the qualification. So there are different options.
We just kind of have some wrap up points to make. Christina, was there any other important points that you think to bring up?
Well, maybe just a little bit more information in terms of the importance of the separation agreement, that some examples of things that could potentially go wrong if they move ahead with financing, if they're able to get that through before having gotten their separation agreement, their spouse could potentially unexpectedly make a claim against the new property that they have just purchased. So that could create a significant legal headache. Another issue that could arise is perhaps the former partner makes a claim for child and or spousal support, and now those additional financial responsibilities make the new house difficult to afford, or, you know, just create significant financial hardship in that way. So it's really important that people know exactly what their financial situation is before they get themselves into new obligations.
And for an ex-spouse to make a claim, would that be common? I feel like that would occur if it wasn't handled properly
in the
first place.
If it's acrimonious.
Yeah, so this would be in the situation where there was no separation agreement in place. If they didn't bother with the separation agreement, a lot of people will say, oh, we're very amicable. We agree on everything. We don't need to have that documented. But things happen in life, and sometimes disagreements do occur in the future. And like I said earlier, the verbal agreement can't be relied on. So you need to have everything properly documented.
I think one of the other things that we've really seen, especially when it comes to separations, is that the team that you have working for you, all those individuals, they have an obligation to you, the client, as a professional. So they're always going to keep their information completely confidential. So even when we're working with two spouses separating, and we could be working on mortgages for both, we work on those two clients separately, and it is all completely confidential. And the same thing, I'm sure, applies to yourself and the legal side.
Well, I work, my role is a little bit unique as a mediator. I'm working with the two parties together. So I'm not his lawyer or her lawyer. I'm actually working for the two of them together as a neutral facilitator. And so they may wish to go and speak to their own lawyer, just to sort of have a set of eyes, look everything over, make sure they feel comfortable before they get everything signed. But with my process, everything actually is completely transparent because we're working together as a team.
I like that that actually is the case, because from our side, we do have to kind of keep things separate. But it's, I think from your side, when you're working through that separation, that probably makes more sense to be able to have everything fully visible on the table.
It streamlines the communication. So there isn't, you know, I'm not a messenger between people. I'm actually facilitating the discussion, and that direct contact helps people hear and understand what is important for the other person, which then helps them know where they should bend, where they should, you know, stick to the things that are really important for them.
That was I think that's a really wise business structure that you have. And you said you're a mobile mediator, essentially, right? So you work with all over BC?
That's right. I work online with clients all over BC. We've been doing that since 2016, which was a little bit innovative at the time. And then the world came online in 2020. And so now everybody's used to the online meetings. But I found it to be a great way to really help people who are going through separation feel more comfortable in these meetings. Not everybody wants to sit together at the same table. It just creates a little bit more comfort and safety and convenience for everyone.
And is it the case too, as reaching out, the earlier the better, I would imagine, right? We use the word destigmatize. There's a lot of stigma around separation. I could imagine people have a lot of feelings of embarrassment. There's a lot of stress. There's a lot of unknown. But it seems like the earlier you reach out, the earlier you start having the communication, the conversations, the less stressful it will be in the long run.
Absolutely, because a lot of the fear that people experience is related to the unknowns. When people are separating, so many different aspects of their life are up in the air. Where are they going to live? What kind of schedule are they going to have for their kids? Is their standard of living going to change drastically? So once people can really fine-tune the financial picture and come to terms around how are the living arrangements going to change, that brings the anxiety down for people, and they can then work together better on coordinating the actual untangling of the finances. And if they have children, focus on the, you know, healthy co-parenting of the children rather than be mired down in fear. I do have a book, which I have available for a free download on the website. You don't have to put in an email or anything. You can just click and download. And that's called Pathways to Amicable Divorce. And I wrote that with the hope that it would help people get started on the right foot, so they don't make a bunch of missteps at the beginning unknowingly that will lead them into a more acrimonious, shall we say, path.
And the website again is modernseparations.com.
That's right.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Christina. It was great having you here on the podcast.
Thank you to the three of you. This was great.
This is The Mortgage Life.
We look forward to continuing the conversation.
So come back and listen.